Welcome to After Hours at the Book Club, a special podcast that is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. And you can find all of our archives on previous podcasts right here on iTunes or go to news.kgnu.org. This month, we're delighted to have Robert Olin Butler join us for After Hours, talking about Perfume River. Arsene Kashkashian, the head buyer with the Boulder Bookstore. This was your selection. I know you've been a fan of Robert's for so many years, and there's so much to talk about in terms of the process of writing. And one thing I want to hear about is the audiobook, because Robert, as a former thespian, you, in fact, have just finished reading the audio version of this.
I have indeed. And this is the fourth book I've done of my own, and I haven't done some others only because I just didn't have the time to do it. My early training was as an actor in the fall of 1963. I went off to Northwestern University, which at the time was the greatest theater school, trained as a method actor and had some considerable success in my undergraduate years, but went on to think that I wanted to write instead of act. And because I was interested in the theater, and because, incidentally, my father was the chairman of the theater department at St. Louis University, I assumed I wanted to write plays. And so I went off and got a master's degree in playwriting at the University of Iowa. I was a terrible playwright, however, and I should have known better. My most impassioned writing was going into the stage directions. Now, that's a very bad sign for a playwright.
Well, I was going to ask, what's the difference between being a good playwright and a good novelist? Because you're an excellent novelist. And
thank you.
What is the difference in the process there?
Well, the impassioned writing in the stage directions meant I was a closeted novelist. The novelist plays, after the Pulitzer, Hollywood found me, and I did 9 theatrical movie screenplays for 7 different studios, none of which got produced, but scripts they loved so much that I kept getting work. I did all that in about 10, 12 years. And screenwriting and playwriting are collaborative art forms. Now, the theater, it's a little more writer-centric because it's more language-driven, but ultimately, the play does not exist, the movie does not exist until all the collaborative artists come in and create the object. The performance of the play or the final movie. And so as a writer of both, you have to, in essence, create fruitful blank spaces that your collaborative artists come in and fill. The novelist, And by the way, in our other conversation about the book itself, I talked about how the experience of literature when we read is a kind of cinema of the mind, and so indeed, the novelist then is all the collaborators. You know, he or she creates. You know, the twist of a word, the lift of an eyebrow, the angle of the sun through the window, you set the scene, you know when to cut, you know the montages to create, you're the director, you're the editor, you're the auteur.
You know, when you read out loud, you know, for the audiobook, do you read while you're writing too, though? Is that part of it?
Sure.
To hear what it sounds like out loud to
Absolutely.
Yourself and make sure, is that part of the whole process as well?
It certainly is an essential part of it, and of course I'm hearing the words in my head as well. I mean, literally hearing the words. But yes, every word written in the book, I read it to myself as I go. I read to my wife at various intervals, and indeed I inhabit the narrative persona. I go back to my acting training. Especially method acting, where it affects my teaching of creative writing too, because most creative writing now is taught, the pedagogy is so focused on craft and technique that you get the impression that to master the craft and technique thoughtfully and to analytically and willfully apply it is part of the creative process. It's not. It's the antithesis. The real process is to inhabit the characters, inhabit the narrator. And that's what I learned in my acting days, how to inhabit the narrator. The narrator of the book, even a third-person narrator in Perfume River, is a character. And the, to inhabit that narrator and then to go through his perspective and to inhabit other characters. So that, you know, that's the way in which that has profoundly influenced how I work.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about inhabit the narrator, because you've had some collections of short stories that are such leaps of imagination. I'm thinking of Severance, Intercourse, Tabloid Dreams, you know, things like that, where you're, maybe you could talk about one of those books and just tell the audience, like, maybe Severance or something, you know. Or,
well, the most extreme, I guess, is Severance.
Yeah, so why don't you tell what you did in that book?
Severance has two epigraphs, one from a French doctor, the 19th century, who says that after due consideration, it's his opinion that there's enough blood left in the brain of a severed head to sustain consciousness for 1.5 minutes. And the other epigraph is from a handbook of speech, which points out that in a heightened state of emotion, we speak at the rate of 160 words a minute. So you would then understand, doing the math, that a minute and a half, 160 words a minute, that every one of the 62 short stories, very short stories in Severance, is exactly 240 words long, representing the last outburst of internal monologue in a recently severed head.
That reminds me, it's like a tweet, isn't that 240 characters or less? Now that has a whole new meaning. Yes. It's before you lose consciousness.
Tweeting for dead people.
That's right. Tweeting from the grave. That's right. So, yes, and for years I wrote. I've come back to writing from at times when my vision of the world requires it. You don't willfully choose point of view any more than you willfully choose any craft and technique. But Perfume River is in the third person and needs to be, because the narrator gets inside of characters in ways that to be able to reveal to us what they have never been able to reveal to each other. But for years, my forte was writing in the first person. And these were, indeed, my book on the creative process called From Where You Dream, my original working title was Method Writing. Because the way I teach, and I think I started this some words ago, that my difference with the pedagogy is that I teach the process, and that in the same way that Stanislavski changed the way acting was thought of, that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, acting was an art of craft and technique. You even with very intelligently, with great observation, you observed the facial expressions, the posture, the tones of voice of characters and their emotions, and then you took them on yourself in a kind of thoughtful, willful way. Stanislavski said, no, the actor's art has to do with bringing the performer's own internal sensory mechanism into alignment with the internal sensory mechanism of the character you're creating. And only then does the external performance happen. And that's the essence of my first person writing in my fiction, is to inhabit the character, get a handle on the deep yearning of that character, which is almost always I yearn for an identity in a self, and then to let that character speak through me.
Now, in Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, your Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of short stories, you talk about Vietnamese exiles in southern Louisiana, and you would talk to them. You speak Vietnamese, right? Is that
true? I mean, that's the crucial thing.
And so you were able to get into that community and really write in those voices.
Yeah,
I mean, how?
But I didn't go into the community and do it. Those characters, not a single character in here is from real life, for one thing, but the leap of imagination occurs from when I really immersed myself in Vietnam, Vietnamized myself, because the Army sent me to language school for a year before I went there. And Vietnamese is not easy because of the tonality, but I picked it up very well, in fact. And for my first day in country, I spoke fluent Vietnamese. I worked 5 months in the countryside in military intelligence, had close contacts with Vietnam. And by the way, from my first day in country, not only did I speak the language, I fell madly in love with Vietnam, with the landscape, with the people, with their culture. And I had close contacts for the first 5 months in the countryside with Vietnamese farmers and woodcutters and provincial police chiefs. Then I was transferred for the last 7 months to Saigon, where I was attached to an American Foreign Service officer at City Hall, Saigon City Hall. He was the advisor to the mayor of Saigon. I worked for him. It was a civilian clothes job in Saigon City Hall. I lived in an old French hotel. And every night for 7 months, my greatest joy was to go after midnight into the steamy back alleys of Saigon, armed only with the language, and approach people and crouch in the doorways with them. Nobody ever seemed to sleep back there. And they were enchanted by my knowing their language, and they inevitably, invariably invited me into their homes, into their culture, into their lives. And so what I know about Vietnam and what made it appropriate for me to write in their voices 18 years later, after it got into my compost heap, that what I knew about them and their culture was learned, madly in love with all of them at their knee. And they were like, and they adopted me. And more than that, because in my 22 books, are they filled all of them, not even half of them, with Vietnamese characters. But much of what I know about the human heart and the human condition, I learned in those back alleys. And so, you know, they have influenced me even in terms of understanding all the other characters I've ever written.
You know, there's a lot of conversation right now about who should write about who. Mm. And, you know, Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, do you think if it came out now, it would be part of that conversation? I mean, it's such a great book, and the way you just described it, you know, it does seem, you know, it makes sense that you would write it. But it feels like there's almost a reflex out there now to oppose or give friction to some of these kind of works.
Yeah, although honestly, back in 1993, there was the consciousness was there too. Mm-hmm. The great thing is that I've had hundreds of contacts, maybe in the four figures now, from Vietnamese people who were not only astonished that I was not Vietnamese, but grateful for my having illuminated the things that were there. And you know, it's interesting. We do not ever question, okay, we don't question an artist's ability to leap over other things imaginatively. For example, I am early aged, I used to say I'm middle-aged, I'm no longer middle-aged, but I am a 71-year-old white guy from the Midwest. I was an only child. My parents, when my father died, they had just passed their 70th wedding anniversary, and the word love was exchanged between us every day of our lives together, okay? I would say that it is a greater leap of imagination for me to write in the voice of a 71-year-old white man from the Midwest who came from a large family with a broken marriage where the word love was never mentioned than it would be to write in the voice of a 90 or a 30, 40-year-old Vietnamese woman who was an only child. Her parents stayed together forever, and love was freely expressed. The latter is a lesser artistic challenge than the former.
Because you identify so much more with that experience?
Absolutely, but no, because we own our identities as, you know, we own our race and our gender and our nationality, but we also own our family relationships, our capacity to love, and all of those other things. And if to say that you really Vietnamese-ness and American-ness, whiteness and yellowness or blackness is prohibits you from being able to access the other imaginatively. Well, I was saying then you can't, if you came from a large family, you cannot imaginatively write about an only child. You know, my only childness is sacrosanct. You understand? And honestly, I think those to write beyond the family relationships is in many ways harder, because those things are the things that make the color of our skin not nearly as important as we all think it is.
But a lot of that discussion that's happening now is who is writing about which community. And there's definitely a different way to America's relationship to Vietnam and an American man who was involved in the military, whatever, in Vietnam, writing about Vietnamese or writing from that perspective than, you know, a leap for me to write about having a big family because I grew up in a small family. I mean, do you see that perspective?
No. No, I mean, there are other non-aesthetic factors involved, of course. But my and if I had just been an artilleryman in Vietnam and had a week of R&R in Saigon and come back and written about the inner lives of Vietnamese, of course. I mean, that would be arguably appropriated. But that's, you know, other things being equal, then no. I mean, you cannot, if you have direct life experience in ways that are authentic, then the fact that I was there because America in its power and its economic status were involved in a civil war with a nation they'd never understood, which we didn't, that those factors, which they don't apply to me. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's why I was there. But that's not, I mean, it's not why I personally was there. And it was not my direct experience. And so as an artist, I say, no, that's, you know, that's another issue. That's a political issue. That's a moral issue. But I'm dealing with the human heart one soul at a time. And my ability to look into another soul, that's not tainted by my country's political idiocy.
But you're such a prolific writer. You've written 22 books at this point. But what are you reading? What inspires you, and what are you reading right now? Do you have time to read?
I do a lot of reading for aspiring writers. I mean, I do a lot of blurbing, and as much as I can. And I read an awful lot of around the historical details. I am halfway through, and I've put it on hold for this book tour, but halfway through the fourth volume of the Christopher Marlowe Cobb thriller series. That's set in World War I, and so it's called Paris in the Dark, and I'm reading about the catacombs, and I'm reading about the ways in which Paris was reacting to the war in the fall of 1915. So there's an awful lot of, and not to mention reading to what was a woman's perfume in Paris in 1915. I mean, a lot of these books, these Cobb books, I probably should be dedicating to Google, because the ability to find out those kind of quotidian details, which are gold for fiction writers, given the cinema of the mind, that stuff it requires intensive research. And the fact that for 4 or 5 or 6, whatever it is now, million books from that era are now before are available in full on the internet is makes that job so much easier.
Yeah, the mystery series, had you always had that in the back of your mind, or is it just something part of your process? You just said, you know, one day you sat down and you started thinking, I want to try something, or I'm just going to do something different.
One of those books of short stories that you were citing, one you didn't cite, but which was also is in that same realm, was a book called Had a Good Time.
Yeah, the postcard one.
I collected postcards for years, and then I took my favorite 15 cards, not so much for the images on the front, but for the messages on the backs. And I took my favorite 15 cards, and we published the front and the back of the card, and I picked there's 15 or 20 or 30. Talk about early tweeting. That was what every city and town in this country had, at least 2 mail deliveries a day in that era. And you could have a passing thought or emotion, and you write it on the back of a postcard, and you could send it to 12 miles, you know, across the county, which was that was a much bigger distance then. I mean, it was early tweeting. But anyway, I wrote that book. One of the stories was a story called The One in White, and it had to do with what I took to be, and wrote the story as an American war correspondent, newspaper war correspondent, covering the invasion of Mexico by Woodrow Wilson in April of 1914, which is kind of not a well-known event. And so a guy named Otto Penzler, and anybody who's interested in mystery stories knows that name. He's the dean of American mm-hmm. publishing of mysteries and thrillers and so forth. He read that story and loved the character and got in touch with me and asked me if you know, offered me a 2-book contract to write at least 2 books in that guy's voice. And as it happened, for the 8 or 9 years, whatever it was that I had been living with that guy, that character, that voice had not settled down. So I thought, being a literary sort, I think my exact quote to Otto was, "Oh boy, you betcha." So, and I've had great fun. And they're very literary. I mean, I've always embraced the surface qualities of a lot of different genres. I wrote a book called Mr. Spaceman, which is science fiction. I wrote a book called Hell, set entirely in hell. I wrote a small hotel, which Oprah magazine called a new old fashioned romance. So I've always embraced that stuff, and I'm having great fun with that series.
That's great. I mean, you've always surprised me, which is one of the reasons I've loved reading you over the years and not knowing what to expect next.
Well, Robert Olin Butler has been our guest on After Hours at the Book Club. It's a podcast collaboration between KGNU Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, Arsene Kashkashian, my co-host as always. You can find more information about our book club series at news.kgnu.org. Thanks, Robert.